Hello, everyone. Can I welcome you to the Oxford Martin School on what is actually a rather nice day for a change? My name is Charles Godfrey. I'm the director here. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Hannah Ritchie. And Hannah Ritchie is actually local as well. She works in the wonderful Our World in Data team. Oh, I see a large number of them in the front row here. And supports Max Rosa as head of research and deputy director, if I've got the deputy editor. And Hannah is a data scientist and with a special interest in the environment, who has written a splendid new book called Not the End of the World. And it's a book that has already had some tremendous comments. I won't read them out, but on the back you have Bill Gates, Margaret Atwood, Tim Harford, David Wallace Wells. So it's a book that's already having a major impact. And Hannah, can I come straight to you and sort of ask you, why did you write this book? And what is the main message that you want to get across in it?
Yeah, I think there's two key reasons for writing the book. I think the first one actually comes from my own personal experience, and I can come on to that. But my background is environmental science. That's what I studied at university. I mean, by the time I got to the end of my degree, I was feeling very, very pessimistic about the state of the world. Like, just all of these trends were getting worse and worse and worse. And I think if you'd asked me 10 or 15 years ago, I was so pessimistic about the state of the world and our ability to solve these problems. And I think we can go into why, but like, I've got a lot more optimistic since then. But I still kind of get this overall feeling and the narrative around these problems that they're unsolvable, we're doomed, there's nothing we can do about it. And I just don't believe that anymore. And I think there are reasons to be cautiously optimistic about our ability to tackle them. And I actually think this mindset of it's too late, there's nothing we can do, is just not productive in moving us forward. So part of the motivation was to push back a bit on that narrative and try to show like these are solvable problems and there's something we can do about it. I think the other core reason I wanted to write the book is that, and it's actually came through in the interviews I've had since then, but the book tackles seven big environmental problems, from climate and air pollution to overfishing and biodiversity loss. I think the issue that I've had, even in the press coverage, is that everyone just focuses on climate change. And I wanted to open that up and present like a broader view of just the suite of large environmental problems that we face, and also kind of to get it more on people's radar, but also to put the solutions to these problems also more in the public domain, so we're not just focusing on climate change.
So in the book, you also talk about your personal transition. And so throw yourself back 10 or 12 years to the young student, Hannah. And what was making you so depressed and sort of teaching at a university? Was it the way that you were being taught? Was it the narrative in the press? Was it your friends, your peer groups? What was it that was most depressing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it even started before university. Like, I feel like I've just kind of always grown up with climate change. And I think even as a kid, I was still already pretty worried and anxious about climate change and what the future might look like, or even if I did have a future. And I'd say that when I went to study environmental sciences at university, that actually just got worse, because you were then in the nitty-gritty of just looking at these trends day after day getting worse and worse. I think there was another dimension to that, that at the time, I think I had this impression that to be an informed citizen, to understand what was going on in the world, you know, it was my duty to always keep up to date with the news. I mean, that was also around the period when the frequency of news reporting was massively increasing. Like, you could instantly get the latest report online, which previously you might have got a daily update or every few days or weekly. So we've seen this rise in the frequency of media reports, and I was hyper-focused on it. And when you look at the news, all you get is the bad stuff, right? You just, like, the news is there to tell you what's the worst thing that's happened in the world today. So that was combined with, you know, disaster after disaster after disaster kind of being thrown at me. And I think that just led me to the situation where I felt like these environmental problems that we faced were unsolvable and just weren't going to get any better. I think that was also combined with the fact that I extrapolated the environmental problems getting worse with human progress metrics also getting worse. So at the time, I was just assuming, just based on the news, that poverty was going up, that child mortality was going up, that hunger, just every metric imaginable was getting worse and worse and worse. And actually that turned out to not be true.
So there's a famous hockey stick diagrams, which essentially has time along one axis and then carbon dioxide emissions and many other things getting bad as you get towards the present day. Do you think one needs a sort of inverse of that, an argument about what actually is getting better? And does your book partly provide that?
Yeah, so the hockey stick graph is like, it's a good summary for most environmental problems, not just really carbon dioxide. I mean, a large part of this has been driven by the Industrial Revolution, so it's kind of flat and then really ramps up very, very quickly. I think you can also see the inverse of that, of a flat and then decrease in most human progress metrics, like child mortality, like extreme poverty, maternal mortality. Over the last few centuries, these problems, you know, have got much, much better. We're not where we want to be, and we still have a lot of progress to make. But on many of these metrics, the world has largely got much, much better. So you have this inverse relationship between human progress and environmental metrics. And kind of the message I wanted to put forward in the book is that I think historically, these have very much been in conflict with one another, right? It has been the human progress that has come at the cost of the environment. And I actually think we're in quite a unique position now, and that's why I frame it as the kind of, we could be the first sustainable generation, where sustainable is taking both sides of that equation into account, where I think we can continue to improve human well-being and human metrics without the environmental damage and by reducing our environmental footprint. I think we tend to only look at one or the other through different lenses. And I think what's really important is you manage to combine them and kind of provide an overall framework of how we move forward.
So a couple of the reviews I've read of your book has sort of linked you with some of the people who have written optimistically, Steve Pinker, for example, and Hans Rosling. And like you, I'm a great fan of Hans Rosling. Might you say a little bit about him and how he influenced you?
Yeah, I mean, I think discovering the work of Hans Rosling was like a really key turning point for me. I don't know if everyone in the audience is aware of him, but he was a Swedish physician, previously like a physician, and he'd give you these amazing TED Talks where he'd show how the world has changed over the last few centuries. And he's way more charismatic than me, so I can't replicate what he did. But he would show that many of the conceptions we have about the world are like often upside down, right? So like if you ask people, is extreme poverty in the world going up or down? They tend to say it's going up. And if you look over the last 200 years, it's dramatically reduced. So it wasn't just showing that, you know, we tend to like not really understand the world. It's that we actively have the wrong perceptions of the world. And many of the human progress metrics we assume to be getting worse are getting much, much better. And that was kind of how I got out of this trap of thinking that everything was getting worse. When I discovered his work, I realized, okay, the environmental stuff is getting worse, but the human progress stuff has been getting much, much better. So I think discovering his work was like a really key turning point for me. And also getting me into the kind of mindset of how to understand the world through data. I think that just wasn't on my radar previously, that you could get a big picture of how the world is changing through the use of data, and you just can't get that through news headlines. I think if I hadn't discovered his work, I don't think I would be working at our own data today. He really kind of drove that passion in me.
I think it's interesting that, there's a number of people who sort of made data an exciting area. So we have Tim Harford on the radio, I'm just blanking on the name of his program.
More or less.
The data geeks ruling and things, if that's not a rude way of putting it. I know that the book is not just about climate change, and we'll go on to talk about some of the other things, but can we first talk a bit about climate change and your views on that there? The genuine narrative around climate change is pretty negative at the moment. People point to the succession of COPs. We're on COP28, I think it is now. And yet the amount of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere is not decelerating. Can you give your argument about why there is reasons to be optimistic around climate change?
Yeah, and I think what the line that was very hard to straddle in the book was putting across what I felt as a more optimistic and realistic vision of where we could go without flipping into complacency. And I think for me, that was actually a very hard line to walk down. And my argument is not that we are on a good path on climate or that we're on an acceptable path on climate. If you look at the trajectory we're on course for 2.5 to 3 degrees, mm-hmm. right? Way above our targets. I think there are a couple of reasons for why I think that could still dramatically change and we can make dramatic progress on that. I think the first one being that we're talking about 2.5 to 3 degrees now, go back 10 years and we're talking about 3.5 to 4 degrees, right? So we have, in some sense, reduced the trajectory that we were on. We're not on a good one, but we're on a better one than we were 10 years ago. And if we can do that over the last 10 years, why can we not go from 2.5 to somewhere closer to 2 degrees or slightly below it? But I think what really makes me much more optimistic than I was a decade ago is that a decade ago, we did not have solutions to climate change, right? When I've been kind of giving this narrative and giving this talk, you know, people push back and say, well, we've had the solutions for decades now. We haven't really made any progress. Like, clearly, we just can't make this. So we're just things are just not going to change. What's really fundamental about the solutions that we need to solve climate change is that they need to be cost competitive with the current technologies that we have, right? 10 years ago, solar, wind, batteries, electric vehicles were way, way more expensive than coal or gas or petrol or diesel. It's very clear why we weren't making any progress 10 years ago, because the alternatives to fossil fuels were just way, way, way too expensive. Over the last 10 years, the prices of these technologies have plummeted such that they're now cost competitive or lower than the costs of fossil fuels. So to me, no, we haven't been working on this problem for decades and not made any progress. We're basically only just at the starting line where we can actually start to make progress because these technologies are competitive. And that's like a really, really fundamental shift that I think people are not quite getting. I think it's wrong to extrapolate, you know, the progress we've made over the last 10 or 15 years and assume that it will continue at that rate. It won't continue at that rate because we're in a fundamentally different position than we were 10 years ago. I think what also just makes me really quite optimistic is that if you look at the current energy system that we have, the amount of waste in that system is just enormous, right? If you just take a diagram of flows of energy from like the energy we burn to like actually providing energy services for people, which is heating, lighting, moving in a car, you know, whatever energy service you want, a really tiny fraction of that is actually going towards energy services. When we decarbonize, so when we move from fossil fuels to solar and wind or other low carbon technologies, when we electrify our energy systems, moving from petrol or diesel to electric cars or towards electric heating, you take away massive amounts of that, those losses in the energy system. So when people see the big stack of energy that we use globally, they assume we'll have to replace all of that with solar, wind, or nuclear, or other technologies. We'll actually have to replace a fraction of that because the total amount of energy that we'll need is much, much lower because we'll get these massive efficiency gains by just taking fossil fuels out of the energy mix. So it's not that I think, you know, this is going to be easy or that, you know, again, we're not on the right path, but I think there are reasons to be more optimistic about our ability to tackle this than there were 10 years ago.
So let me push back a little bit on that. And given that we really do need to get to net zero by the middle of this century, like you, I'm just amazed by what's happened in the energy transition. Who would have known, for example, the price of photovoltaics would have come down like it has. But the energy sector is a relatively easy sector to decarbonize because it's a relatively small number of large actors, and it's not you and me and everyone else in this room having to make personal hard decisions about paying for home insulation, paying for a much more efficient boiler, or changing our diets. So is there a risk of being overly optimistic because of the energy sector compared with the challenges that we face in the other sectors?
I think that applies to energy, and I think it applies to, in some sense, industry. Industry is big actors. And I actually think on industry, we're further behind than we are on fundamental energy. I think those innovations,
cement and things.
I think will come. They're just not there yet. I think food, for me, is I'm actually much more pessimistic on food than I am on energy, because I think it relies much more on individual behaviour change and individual choices. I think when you're talking about energy, most people, yeah, they might have some small preferences about where it comes from. Fundamentally, they just want cheap, reliable energy that they can plug. When they plug a socket in, they want cheap energy out. I think if you can provide that, most people are happy with that. I think food is very different. It's like very tied to identity. It's very much more politicized. I think food fundamentally will be much harder. I think I've had this comment that like there is like a little bit of a difference in the tone maybe from the energy climate chapters to the food chapters. Actually, I think what I wanted to do a bit with the food chapters is less say here's this like really obvious solution, because I think that will be harder, but actually just fundamentally to communicate to people that it's a big environmental problem. I think when you talk about these like climate change or other problems, people automatically think fossil fuels. Like, I don't need to really convince anyone of that. But I think people miss the food stuff, which when you're talking about any of the other environmental problems, including climate, it's just like not really on people's radar. So I also wanted to like give food a bit more of a profile of saying this is a big problem as well.
You talk a little bit about the idea of decoupling and the argument that we need to decouple economic growth from environmental footprint, essentially. And you're quite optimistic, if I've understood you right, about that we're actually making progress in that direction. And you've had some pushback from that from people who are advocating for really, really quite radical decoupling and what that means to the whole economic structure with which we organise our societies. Might you give a little more texture about why you're optimistic in that area?
Yeah, so the clear argument there is if you look historically, CO2 emissions, but you could use really any kind of material metric, has been very tightly coupled to economic growth, right? So it's been a very, very strong relationship. As economies grow, people use more energy, therefore you get more fossil fuels, more carbon emissions. And therefore you might then lead to the conclusion the only way you get emissions and fossil fuel use down is to use less energy and to shrink the economy. I think two clear pushbacks on that is that that's very fundamentally not a solution for a large part of the world where their primary concern is lifting people out of poverty, lifting people out of energy poverty, and economic growth is really central to that. So then you have the question of can rich countries actually decouple those impacts? So can you have still a growing economy while shrinking CO2 emissions or energy use? And the data suggests, yes, you can. Like, we are starting to see absolute decoupling between these two metrics across a range of countries. I think the very valid argument there and pushback is that this is not happening fast enough, right? It's not happening anywhere near fast enough, and definitely not for 1.5 degrees, but even for 2 degrees, that decoupling is not happening fast enough. I think my argument on that there would be, again, this decoupling has largely happened when the alternatives to fossil fuels have been expensive. Right, so that the decoupling has happened in a world where it actually wasn't that economically advantageous to make that transition. I think that economic argument actually gets stronger and stronger every day, and I think there are still massive gains through electrification of transport, through electrification of heating, where you can really start to push that decoupling much faster. So I think again, there's like a balance there. I think decoupling is happening, but not happening fast enough. To me, I just fundamentally don't see any alternative to decoupling, because I think politically, just the being able to sell a message of degrowth to me just doesn't seem feasible.
Can I also bring up the issue of tipping points? And I want to ask in two ways. So is there a possibility that you're quite optimistic about what might happen if we manage to get to a trajectory to take us to 2 degrees. But is there not a worry about that the climate system may tip over, switch over into a different domain? So that's a negative aspect of tipping points. Can you also see some positive tipping points, something that might happen that when you write the fifth edition of this in 25 years' time, you say, I wasn't as optimistic as I should have been there?
Yeah, I mean, I would start with the positive. I mean, I think many of these technologies are fundamentally like on the brink of what we might frame as positive tipping points. I think these technologies they follow what we call learning curves, where the more you deploy them, the more the cost falls. The more you deploy them, the more the cost falls. So it tends to be this reinforcing action. But in terms of deployment, they tend to follow what we would call S curves, where the growth at the beginning is very slow, and then you actually reach a kind of tipping point where you start to get very, very fast growth. And there are a range of, you know, estimates of what we think the tipping point is for like solar or wind or electric cars, for example. I think in many countries in the world, we actually are starting to reach that tipping point. I think there's very clear, an electric vehicle market, for example, the very clear countries in Europe where, you know, started off very slow, and now most car sales are now electric. So I think there is room for more optimism on the fact that, you know, this stuff could happen much, much faster than we are anticipating if we hit these kind of positive.
But I was also thinking about sort of dramatic new technologies. Fusion is obviously something that's been talked about for a long time, but there's a lot of excitement in fusion that there wasn't a few years back. So for all of us who've got a couple of fivers under our mattress, what are the sectors that we should be putting our money into?
Yeah, I mean, I think I have often been framed in interviews and stuff as a techno-optimist, and maybe to some extent I am. I kind of push back on that a little bit, because I think the technologies that I'm optimistic about are the already established ones. Like, I'm just really optimistic about solar and wind and batteries. And actually, there's probably much more room for techno-optimism, which is like looking at technologies that we just don't really know we have yet or aren't established. I mean, some of the key ones on energy, yes, fusion would be a very clear one. I think there's some untapped ones that we just don't really talk about, like geothermal. I think that's, in some sense, maybe geothermal is where solar and wind was 10 years ago. A decade from now, we might be talking about that technology in a different way. I think actually that a mix with geothermal could actually solve many of the problems we think we might encounter with solar and wind. So for example, the key challenge for the UK for solar and wind will be not short-term storage, because we have batteries for that, but, you know, seasonal storage, and having less variable renewables like geothermal might fill a key gap there. So I think that's a particular technology that could be untapped. I mean, there's stuff like food. I mean, lab-grown meat. If we can produce lab-grown meat, basically just produce meat without the animals, it would just be an actual fundamental game changer. So I think, yeah, maybe these technologies are coming, but I've undersold where they'll be, and I'll be very happy to be under-optimistic on that.
So the pessimistic one.
On the pessimistic one, I think there are maybe a couple of misconceptions about tipping points. I think this is two angles. Some people just don't think about them at all, and then some people maybe misinterpret some of the issues on tipping points. I think fundamentally, some people interpret 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees as like the tipping point. I mean, I've been asked in interviews, you know, do I not agree with scientists that there's the tipping point? There's not the tipping point. There are a series of tipping points of different
magnitude. There could be a sort of technical tipping point, and sort of examples such as the North Atlantic currents switching off so that one gets a radically different climate in this part of the world. And there's a paper a couple of weeks back saying that this was more likely to happen than previous estimates, or radical degassing of the permafrost. So something which really does change over decades rather than a long time.
Yeah, so I think those are tipping points. They're not like, I think people have this impression that, you know, there's just a full planetary scale tipping point that, you know, we're suddenly at 1.8 degrees and then we end up at 5 degrees. And it is a series of tipping points, and those tipping points have very different magnitudes. So the ones you're talking about there are much larger impact than some of the others. I think what's very clear is that it's very unknown. It's very unknown where these are in the system and what the potential magnitudes would be, but if you go based on our best knowledge today, there are some tipping points that we expect below 1.5 and 2 degrees, for example, and that's stuff like Arctic sea ice free Arctic in the summer, or the Amazon rainforest tipping point, for example. And these are all very serious, and these are especially have very, very serious localised ecosystem impacts. If you're looking at global scale, some of these tipping points, the impact they would have, like an Arctic sea ice free summer would increase global temperatures, what we think, between 0.1 and 0.15. The Amazon rainforest possibly the same. So what if we were to hit several tipping points on the way to 2 degrees, 3 or 4, for example, you might be talking about 0.3 or 0.4 degrees extra warming, which is obviously very bad and would take us, you know, if we're at 1.8, we'd be at 2.2, which is obviously very, very serious. But I think what people assume is that, you know, you go from 1.8 to, you know, 5 degrees within years or decades. And that's not really the story of tipping points. There are also some really like massive tipping points, like melting of ice sheets. Mm-hmm. And there you're talking about, you know, 7+ meters of sea level rise. I think there the important point is time scale, where I think people often imagine, you know, the collapse of an ice sheet. They imagine when scientists say collapse, you know, it's within a year or a couple of years. These tend to occur over centuries or millennia. So that's not to say that 7 meters of sea level rise is fine in 2200, but it's a fundamentally different problem from if that's happening in the course of years.
So, having promised not to talk too much about climate, I've talked a lot about climate, but I want to switch to food now. And food's a particular interest of mine, so I thought, right, I'll be able to find lots of things to argue with Hannah on this, and I'm a complete failure because I sort of violently agree with nearly everything you say in there. So, like you, I'm an optimist on food. So what do we need to do to have a healthy, sustainable, and equitable food system? What are your sort of top three go-to policy interventions?
I think the really first fundamental one is a real clear focus on agricultural productivity. The big success story on food over the last 50 years, and if you go back 50 or so years, you know, predicted you would have seen massive famines, millions and millions of death from famines. That hasn't happened, and that's largely not happened because of increased crop yields and agricultural productivity. There are still massive opportunities we have in the agricultural system to do that much further. And in particular, very large, what we call yield gaps between the yield we have today and the yield we could attain if we were using best current practices, irrigation, better seeds, etc. In some regions, that gap is still really, really large. And one of the regions in particular I focus on is sub-Saharan Africa, where yields have increased over the last few decades, but they're way, way below the global average and way, way below what we think the attainable yields could be. I think actually increasing agricultural productivity there was actually fundamental, not just to solving environmental challenges, but also just fundamental to socioeconomic development. Most of the world's smallholder farmers, very close to the poverty line, are currently in sub-Saharan Africa. And without gains in agricultural productivity there, probably will be very, very hard to tackle extreme poverty in that region. So there's a very fundamental human development lens to that, which goes hand in hand with the environmental issue. And the core part of increasing agricultural productivity is that you produce more food from less land. So less deforestation, less habitat loss. We could even produce more food using less land than we currently do today if we were to really optimize that.
But you're not a fan of vertical farming as one way of doing that.
No, I'm quite critical of vertical farming in the book. Not because it couldn't work in practice, but I think there's just the inherent trade-off between vertical farming is you're switching land for energy. And when you just run the costs on energy, whether it's economic costs or energy costs, the math just doesn't really work right now. Maybe that will be like one of the breakthroughs that I'm too pessimistic
about. So number one is closing the yield gap.
Yeah.
Number two?
Number two is globally eating less meat.
Yeah.
It filters through so many problems in the book that the global meat production and consumption is too high and has really, really high environmental costs.
And high in the middle and high income countries in particular.
Yeah, there's a very large gap in per capita meat consumption across countries in the world. And it tends to, again, there's a very strong relationship between GDP and meat consumption. As people get richer, they tend to eat more meat. So when I'm saying eat less, like the world needs to eat less meat, I'm not saying, you know, the person in Chad eating 2 kilograms a year needs to eat less meat. That's actually probably really key to nutrition in that context. But especially in high-income countries in the West, per capita meat consumption is just really, really high. And I think there are a range of models to do that. I think I've maybe in the past been too optimistic about theory of change for doing that. I think in my head, I thought, if we have, to me, I think we just already have like pretty good meat substitutes on the market, and I think they're tasty, and I think like for me, I really like them. I think I had this notion that if they just got cheap enough and if they just got good enough, people would just make that switch. I don't think we're really seeing that switch, and nowhere near the scale or speed that we would need. I think there I am actually kind of hinging on this kind of technological breakthrough of lab-grown meat, because I think for some people, the only alternative to meat is meat, just without the animal. So I think that, yeah, moving away from meat consumption is a really fundamental pillar.
So what would you say to people whose livelihoods depend on raising cattle, this country, in middle and high-income countries? What is the narrative that can persuade people that they're part of the solution and not just going to be thrown out of a job?
I mean, I think the clear point there is that this is not going to happen overnight.
Yeah.
Mm. Right? Like, this is going to be a transition over decades, and it's not, we're going to, you know, flip immediately to this completely plant-based world. And I actually think if we are to do this smartly, acknowledging the fact that we're not going to just stop eating meat overnight, as we go on that pathway towards a more plant-based world, we also want to do that in the most sustainable way we can, which means optimizing the meat production, the meat that we are producing, and trying to optimize for less damaging and more sustainable practices. So I think fundamentally, we also need to create this reward system where on that pathway, the meat we are producing and consuming is as environmentally friendly as we can possibly be. So I think it's not one or the other. It's not like a fully meat or no meat. I think there will be this transition period where we also need to optimise the meat that we are producing.
So closing the yield gap, research to actually come up with new technologies, diet change, you're talking about book about food waste at all. So tongue-in-cheek, let me add the other one. Clearly we need to get out of palm oil. That's surely right, Anna.
It's a little bit more complex than
Go
that.
Go ahead.
Like, yeah, so like I remember when I came to work on deforestation at Our Own Data, so just the broad, like, what's going on with deforestation? I think I also had in my head, you know, the evil villain here is palm oil, and we just need to boycott palm oil and get that out of the system, and we'll tackle a big part of global deforestation. I think then I started to read reports on this, and what were the experts saying, and that wasn't really the clear story that was coming through. I think one, fundamentally, we need to acknowledge palm oil has been environmentally destructive. Like, it has led to significant amounts of tropical deforestation, in particular in Indonesia and Malaysia, where most palm oil was produced. But I think if you're to think about this as a, yeah, we should just boycott palm oil, you also need to take into account what the counterfactual would be. And one of the, maybe the benefits and also weakness of palm oil is it's such a productive crop. Like, if you look at the amount of oil you can produce per hectare, if you compare it to some other vegetable crops, you're talking about like 5 to 10 times as much. So if your global demand for vegetable oil is fixed, and you can argue it should be less, but let's just imagine that it's fixed. If you're not producing that through palm oil and you switch that to another crop, you will probably need more land. Now, if you're switching to other tropical crops, which many companies have done, right? They've boycotted palm oil but went for soybean oil or coconut oil, you could actually result in higher tropical deforestation because you might need 5 to 10 times as much land. So I think the story there is not this simple, we need to boycott palm oil. I think it's fundamentally, we need to acknowledge that it has led to environmental deforestation, but the focus needs to be on, can we produce palm oil without deforestation? Can we produce palm oil in a more sustainable way? So we get the benefits of the high yields, but we do it without leading to more environmental damage. So that's more leaning towards, you know, there's the RSPO, which is the Responsible Palm Oil Association, more leaning towards that than just this like blanket boycott.
And you make the good point that the RSPA is a round table for sustainable palm oil, which has done a good job, but could do a better job if it was pushed. I'm going to come to the audience in a moment, but there are two final questions. Well, two final things that I'd like to ask you to do. You talk about fisheries, and again, a theme throughout the book that if you look at the data, it gives you a different perspective. Might you just, I thought it's a lovely story about how what was initially an argument came together to help resolve an issue. So worms versus Hilburn.
Yeah, so there was two scientists, worms versus Hilburn. So one was very much a kind of ecologist, like very much focused on marine ecology, and the other was like a fisheries specialist. I mean, you might assume that they would have like a very unified understanding of what's going on in the oceans, but actually the desired outcome is actually quite different there, right? If you're a fisheries scientist, your aim is like, how do I catch as much fish as I possibly can without reducing fish stocks and fish populations, right? You're looking for that like optimization of fisheries, whereas a marine ecologist might be, you know, we want to restore the oceans back to what it was before humans came along. So actually, like, maybe quite fundamental differences in how they see the kind of sustainable fishery equation. But yeah, there was this kind of what arose as a conflict because Worms had published a paper on the state of fisheries across the world. And actually, there was like a final, just a kind of almost like a throwaway line in the conclusion, which like blew up into the headline you might have heard, but the ocean will be empty by 2048. Now that claim has been repeated over and over, but actually came from this initial paper where he was looking at what he thought was decline of fish stocks over time. And he said, if you just extrapolate this line, which is, you know, it's very debatable, if you just extrapolate this line, it will be 100% by 2048. So that's how it led to this headline. Now, Ray Hilburn was a fisheries scientist, and the data Warren was using just didn't tally with what he was seeing in the real world. He thought, you know, fundamentally, he was monitoring lots of fish stocks that were not declining, and therefore, you know, couldn't really see how that was matching up with the real world. So they went on the radio, and what the radio presenter would be like a really fierce head-to-head. They actually quite liked each other. And in the end, it resulted in a collaboration where the two of them came together to say, can we actually just build a database where we try to understand what's happening to fish stocks across the world? And they did that, and it was very successful, and it got republished. And actually what you see there was, again, this kind of mixed trend that, like, overall, fish stocks and the stocks that they'd studied was not actually going up or down. It was increasing in some areas, and it was decreasing in others, but on net, you actually didn't see a net decline over time. So I think that was, like, a key story where really opposing scientists ended up coming together, collaborating, and actually developing a really key data set that's still used today, and we use it in our own data, that's really improved our understanding of fisheries.
And it's a great example of how concentrating on the data can help sort of resolve some issues. Of course, when you go into policy, then there's a lot that's above it, but we should be arguing about the values and things going into policy. We shouldn't be arguing about the data. That should be something that could be resolved. Okay, the final thing I want to ask you, so like you, I'm generally an optimist. I hate what is sometimes called the pornography of doom, when you get up and you get either a lecture or a television program that is just hitting you round the cheeks. And I guess the times that I find my optimism slipping is when I look at, for example, the political polarization that's one seeing in the States, which really has climate change and much of the environment part of that. Thankfully, and fingers crossed, we've been spared the worst of it here, but maybe not. And as I talk in London recently, where a really smart man called Jürgen Vogler, who is vice president for sustainability at the World Bank and coined the term climate change, climate smart agriculture, And he said, well, we have so many of these solutions, but we have the narrative wrong. And if you look what's happening in continental Europe at the moment with farmers protesting all over the place. So, Hannah, cheer me up on that political side. Do you see, are we going through a spasm at the moment of a sort of backlash? Do you see hope in the political narrative, the political economy, that we'll have a better approach to climate change going ahead?
I think that there are some particular issues, and I think food is like a really fundamental one, where there's quite strong political pushback to a specific policy proposal. What I think is much less polarised than people assume is just overall belief in climate change, or belief that climate change is a problem, or that people should do something about it, right? If you look at surveys across the world, you're talking about 75%+ of people in every country saying, I think climate change is a problem, I want my government to do something about it. And I actually think that the political divide from, you can see this as like a left-right issue, is much narrower than people assume it to be. And the data shows this very clearly, and I think the media is actually doing us all a detriment by trying to reinforce that this is a really, really divided issue. It's not a divided issue. And I think if we keep telling ourselves a story that's a divided issue, then actually we talk ourselves out of these solutions that actually just most people in most countries want. I think what's also really clear from the data is that even in areas where the climate problem is politicised, some of the solutions are really, really not politicised. So if you take the US as an example, that's the one country where the partisan gap on climate is big, right? Democrats really care about climate change. Republicans, you're talking about maybe half, right? So there's a really broad gap. That gap almost completely disappears if you talk about clean energy, right? Everyone wants clean energy. And actually, it doesn't fundamentally matter whether they believe in climate change or not. If the outcome is that they really want clean energy, then the outcome is the same. It's reduced carbon emissions and it's more clean energy.
Air pollution is.
And air pollution is fundamental. Mm. What's really key in the differences in that data in the US is that the reasons for wanting clean energy are different across the aisle, right? If Democrats, it's to tackle climate change. For Republicans, it tends to be energy security, incomes for landowners, like for wind sites, for example. So it's an economic argument, and it's a local pollution argument, and that's what they care about. I think that also really matters to how we message this, right? I'm not going to get anywhere if I go into the middle of Texas with my climate crisis placard, or actually fundamentally my book, but if I just go in and talk about the other co-benefits of clean energy, I'm much more likely to be successful in driving action and actually getting people on board. So I think we are overselling how politicised climate change and these problems are, and I actually think it's to our detriment.
Thank you. Right, I'm going to go to the audience for questions. We are broadcasting this, so do bear that in mind when you ask a question. And also, can I request to have the questions as brief as possible so we hear from Hannah? The lady of the green jersey and then behind her in the white.
Hannah, and Charles as well, I put it to you both that you're thinking inside the box. Hannah said early on, she cannot imagine any solution other than decoupling. She dismissed economic degrowth, just like that. No mention of maximizing mitigation from the dangers ahead, no mention of minimizing consumption per capita, or even thinking about minimizing our population growth.
I'll argue about answer on population growth. Do you want to go first?
So on degrowth and reducing the economy, I mean, the fundamental challenge there is political feasibility, right? And actually what's really key is the timescales that we're talking about solving this problem on. If we had 40 years to fundamentally change our whole economic system, then maybe I could agree with that. I think what's really fundamental is like we need to get moving on this now. And if you're looking at the political systems we currently have, I cannot see a way by which a UK or even a US or any politician stands up and like advocates as this as their core policy choice or that actually people vote for them. I mean, at the next election, like, neither Rishi Sunak or Keir Starmer are going to promote this as a key policy choice. So then you're talking about, okay, then we've wasted 4 or 5 years. Again, I think even in 4 or 5 years, I think it's very, very unlikely that a politician will stand up and advocate for that and then also so get votes for that and voted into to politics. You would need to see this shift in, like, every country in the world. And I think when the time scales that we're talking about, I cannot fundamentally see that shift. And I think there are other ways by which you can tackle what you might think as excess consumption, but I think framing it around degrowth, I just don't think we'll get political support, I'm afraid.
And just hijacking the question, because my background is in population biology, the news about human populations is just extraordinarily good news. You bring people out of poverty, you educate their children, you provide access to reproductive health care, and natural fecundity drops. We've already gone through peak children at the moment. The only reason the major reason global populations are increasing at the moment are people are living longer, which is a good thing. So all the things we have to worry about, then population growth is not one. The demographic transition in rich countries, as more people get old, there's some real challenges there, but that is a temporary one. Behind.
So I guess my question is, what do you do when data isn't enough? So you kind of speak, I guess, like, you know, we just need to show people this information and they'll make the right decisions. But I don't think that's always the case. So, like, for people who make models or scientists or whatever, and they show it to, you know, policymakers, and that's just not enough to convince them, what would you say is the solution there?
No, I agree. Like, I think, I often get the question or the pushback that, you know, people just never make decisions based on data. I don't think that's true. I think we all make decisions based on data every day. But I agree that often the data, you know, just presenting the data to people is just often not enough to change their mind. I think narrative is important. I think having a narrative shaped around data is fundamental to, like, get more of a personal connection of, like, what does that showing that data actually mean for someone in their life? Like, just saying energy costs fall, okay, what does that actually mean for consumer electricity bills? So making that link between the data and what it fundamentally means for people in their lives, I think, is really crucial. I think as this links to narrative over time, I think the data then starts to reinforce that. I think once you see the data start to play out in actual real life metrics, I think it actually makes it much, much easier to continue to communicate through data. So on energy costs, for example, it's easy to just say, yeah, the energy costs have fallen, until it actually translates into what people can see on, like, macroeconomic data. I think that's harder, but I think it does start to get easier over time as it filters through.
Thank you. A question there, halfway down.
Hi, thank you for the conversation. Hannah, I completely agree with you that these problems are solvable and that there's lots we can and need to do. At the same time, I checked that our World in Data carbon emissions this morning, in the most recent year you've got 2022, is the highest kind of carbon emissions in history. Admittedly, the last few years have plateaued a little bit. So given your book's called Not the End of the World, what kind of year time frame, if you had to take the fiver from under the mattress, do you think we will have halved emissions, and when do you think we'll have reached net zero?
Yeah, I think where we are on carbon emissions is that I think we are approaching peak. So if you look at carbon emissions over time, they grew really strongly in the 1990s, grew really strongly in the 2000s. Over the last 5 or so years, or maybe 5, 10 years, they're going up a little bit, mostly plateaued. And I think fundamentally, if you look at any of the projections from IEA or other similar organizations, the expectation of the peak will come in the next few years. I think the big question mark is how fast the decline is. I mean, peaking is not what we're going for. We need to go for a very, very fast decline. I can't give a specific date on when I think we'll half emissions. I mean, we will not have emissions to be, you know, in line with 1.5. I mean, I think for me, fundamentally, 1.5 degrees will be off the table. I think 2 degrees is still in play. I think 2 degrees for me is like the ambitious. Like, this will be really ambitious, but is possible. I think on net zero, I think the question mark will be over the net bit. We won't be at zero emissions in 2050. We could be at net zero emissions around that 2050 to 2060 mark. I think what we need to think about on that very clearly is how net zero globally translates into net zero across different countries and different responsibilities. If we're going for net zero globally, rich countries should be at net zero well before 2050, and their current plans are not in line with that. So I think that would be my fundamental criticism of rich countries, is that net zero globally 2050 needs to be net zero rich countries 2040, 2045.
Hannah Mitchell, could we go for a question from online?
Yep, so a few different people online are asking about climate justice and how we can help the countries most directly affected by climate change and amplify their voices and their possible solutions.
Yeah, I think that's like really key, is like one, to highlight the large inequality in the problem, not just on who's responsible for it and who has the most leverage to tackle it, but also how the inequalities and the impacts of climate change. I think I get this question a lot of the UK only emits 1% of the world's emissions, like why should we really care? Like what we do doesn't make a difference. I mean, one, it does fundamentally make a difference. But I think this is an argument that extends to most rich countries in the world. That I don't, for me, their role is not just to get their domestic emissions low or as close to zero as possible. I think what's really fundamental is that if they want middle and low income countries to also move to clean energy and do that in a much faster way, their role is to massively bring down the cost of these energy technologies so middle and low income countries are not faced with the dilemma, do I lift people out of energy poverty or do I keep my CO2 emissions low? What should be fundamental there is that the low carbon option is just the cheapest option anyway, therefore they go for that and there's no inherent trade-off. So I think that a big part of the climate justice story is primarily also through rich countries driving innovation in these technologies such that other countries can benefit. And then there's the very obvious, you know, more direct transfer of how do you support lower income countries who are facing these impacts. I think one is there a kind of reactionary approach, more like loss and damage of providing funding when disaster does strike. I think there's even stuff that's less seen as this kind of option, but is more related to agricultural productivity. Like a key role that richer countries can play is in the development of more resilient agricultural systems, but doesn't just benefit, you know, in a world of a changing climate. It's just fundamentally good and beneficial to do anyway.
Right, we're running out of time, so I'm going to take three questions. Could they be very short, please? And if you take one from the back, one from the middle, and one from the front. But very short, please.
Yeah, you were talking about electrification as your reason for being optimistic. What are your thoughts on the countries that rely heavily on coal to produce electricity?
So coal as an issue. If you come to the middle, Hannah. Hands up, who wants to ask a question from the middle?
So I wanted to know, you put a lot of emphasis on kind of having improved crop yields, which is a large result of genetic modification in plants. But many countries, such as the sub-Saharan African countries, have bans against GM crops. So how do you believe that we get around that? Richer countries can't really contribute to that as much.
So GM, although all the gains so far have largely not been GM, so GM is something in the future.
Yeah. I very much liked your perspective on virtually everything. And one thing I liked was when you're talking about the human health effects of air pollution, here today you didn't give any numbers to it, but in your book you do, and you cite the numbers, you know, from Global Burden of Disease and various other sources. I think these numbers may be wrong, the wrong order of magnitude, really, massively wrong and massively exaggerated. The human health effects of air pollution may be much less than you say numerically in your book. And of course, this is completely irrelevant to the question of climate change. This is talking about just the human health effects of pollutants.
So air pollution, have you overestimated?
Where do those numbers come from? And could you reconsider them, please?
So coal, GM and air pollution data.
So on air pollution, I mean, there are now like a really broad range of estimates for what we would classify as premature deaths from air pollution. I don't just rely on the global burden of disease. There are now a range of studies, and they all tend to be in the millions, right? So the median estimate from the WHO is 7 million. I can range from a few million to 9 million. These are the things I'm
objecting to. Okay, I think this is a discussion for over a soft drink outside. GM cool.
Yeah, GMs, as Charles said, like a lot of the yield gap we currently have, if you look at Sub-Saharan Africa, for example, is not actually based on GM. It's just based on traditional crops. You could argue that GM would increase that, and you could push that yield even higher. But I think there's still massive gains, even if you don't take GM into account. And then on the coal and electricity, yeah, I think countries will just move away from coal from electricity. I think thinking about electrified transport, moving from petrol diesel car to an electric car, even if it's running on coal, it's still better on carbon. It's obviously much less beneficial than if you're using solar or wind, but even just fundamentally using coal is carbon beneficial. And I think the differential there will just increase over time because countries will then start to decarbonize electricity as well. But obviously the fundamental is that you don't just do electrification and leave a carbon rich electricity mix, you do both at the same time.
Okay, that's brilliant. I think we can do a final round of three. So sorry, Hannah, thank you. So we'll do one from the, I'll let you pick one from the back, one from the middle, one from the front.
Hannah, thank you. How do you define rich countries and other countries? Like, where do you draw the line between different sets of countries?
Okay, nice. Chat with the beard there, if that's not a wrong thing to accuse someone of having.
Okay, so you talked about behavior change in adaptation to, for example, substitutes to meat. But when you were talking about agricultural productivity, do the farmers also need to change behavior because people talk about sustainable ways of doing agriculture as opposed to the kind of intensification that you talk about, especially coming from the green evolution?
And Hannah, there's one right in the front here.
Hi, thank you. There's a fair amount of criticism of the manufacturing of electric vehicles, such as local environmental degradation from lithium mining. How do you think this can be improved, both in terms of the solutions to the lithium mining and other problems, and also in terms of the narratives regarding this? Thank you.
Brilliant. Three very concise questions.
So on the minerals, electric mining story, there's lots of challenges there. There's lots of pushback there. One is, do we have enough minerals? Yes, we do have enough minerals overall. There's issues of social justice issues in supply chains, environmental issues in supply chains. Those are all very valid criticisms, but they're not unsolvable problems, right? They're just problems. I think some of the kind of social justice issues, actually, I think we are actually already tackling. There's always this link between cobalt and batteries and electric cars, which cobalt is primarily mined in the DRC with really poor human working standards. I think in the future, batteries will probably just not use cobalt. We're already moving away from cobalt and batteries. And I think you actually will start to see the same story for lithium. There actually probably is a viable pathway for which we also no longer use lithium and batteries. But I think the question of how do we do this in a socially, environmentally non-degrading way is really fundamental. With these questions, what I always think is really important for us to highlight is that if we are looking for an absolute perfect solution, there are none, right? If you're looking for the solution that needs no minerals, that needs no land, that has zero impacts whatsoever, we will just maintain the fossil fuel system that we currently have. We're looking for solutions that are orders of magnitude better than fossil fuels, and we have them, and there's still issues that we need to work out, but I think we need to pause before we, take a solution completely off the table because it has some impact. We just need to work on reducing that impact.
Farmer behaviour?
I mean, I think fundamentally, actually, I think that's easier than individual consumer behaviour change. But I think, because I think often they're just the incentives will line up, right? It's in a farmer's interest to have high productivity, to not use more fertilizer or more pesticides than they need, to not over-apply water, but be able to access irrigation when they need it. So I think fundamentally there, I think if you provide farmers with good information on how they can make the best decisions, I actually think that that's much more compatible than consumer behavior, where those incentives are not as strongly aligned.
And the last one I think was an easy one, the metrics, how you define different countries and different income brackets.
There I'm just like typically using like World Bank income categories. I mean, there's obviously like a line there, and there'll be some countries just below it and just above it. So like a fundamental line doesn't make sense. But yeah, I'm just mainly talking about World Bank income groups.
Okay, we've run out of time. Next door, we have some books to buy if you're interested, and also some soft drinks. So do join us next door. Hannah, this has been tremendous. Thank you so much. The one thing I'd say about the book is it's intellectually really stimulating. It's wonderfully written. You write like an angel. So it's an easy book to read.